But in some cases the dead person has secrets, Tengo said. And when the hole's filled in, those secrets are never known.
I think that's necessary, too.
How come?
Certain secrets can't be left behind.
Why not? Kumi let go of his hand and looked at him, right in the face.
There's something about those secrets that only the deceased person can rightly understand. Something that can't be explained, no matter how hard you try. They're what the dead person has to take with him to his grave, like a valuable piece of luggage.
Tengo silently looked down at the puddle of light at his feet. The linoleum floor shone dully. In front of him were his worn loafers and Kumi's simple black pumps. They were right in front of him, but looked miles away.
There must be things about you too, Tengo, that you can't explain to others.
Could be, Tengo replied. Kumi didn't say anything and crossed her slim black stockinged legs. You told me you died once before, didn't you? Tengo asked.
I did die once, on a lonely night when a cold rain was falling.
Do you remember it?
I think so. I've dreamt about it for a long time. A very realistic dream, always exactly the same. So I have to believe that it happened.
Was it like reincarnation?
Reincarnation?
Where you're reborn. Transmigration. Kumi gave it some thought.
I wonder, maybe it was, or maybe it wasn't.
After you died, were you cremated like this?
Kumi shook her head. I don't remember that far, since that would be after I died. What I remember is the moment I died. Someone was strangling me, a man I had never seen before.
Do you recall his face?
Of course. I saw him many times in my dreams. If I ran across him on the street, I would recognize him right away.
What would you do if you saw him in real life?
Kumi rubbed her nose, as if checking to see if it was still there. I've thought about that, too, what I would do if I ran across him on the street. Maybe I would run away. Or maybe I would follow him so he wouldn't notice me. Unless I was actually put in that situation, I don't know what I would do.
If you followed him, what would you do then?
I don't know. But maybe that man holds some vital secret about me. And if I play my cards right, he might reveal it to me.
What kind of secret?
For instance, the reason why I'm here.
But that guy might kill you again.
Maybe, Kumi said, lips slightly pursed. I know it's dangerous. It might be better just to run away. But still, the secret draws me in. Like when there's a dark entrance and cats can't help but peep in.
The cremation was over, and Tengo and Kumi, following tradition, picked up select bones from his father's remains and placed them in a small urn. The urn was handed to Tengo. He had no idea what he should do with it, though he knew he couldn't just abandon it. So he clutched the vase in his hands as he and Kumi took a taxi to the station.
I will take care of any remaining details, Kumi told him in the cab.
After a moment, she added,
If you would like, I could see about interring the bones, too.
Tengo was startled.
You can do that. I don't see why not, Kumi said.
There are some funerals where not a single person from the family attends.
That would be a big help, Tengo said.
And he handed her the urn, feeling a little guilty, but honestly relieved.
I will probably never see these bones again, he thought.
All that is left will be memories, and eventually they too will vanish like dust.
I'm from here, so I think I can take care of it. It's better if you go back to Tokyo right away. We all like you a lot here, but this isn't a place you should stay for long.
I'm leaving the cat town, Tengo mused. Thank you for everything you've done, Tengo said.
Tengo, do you mind if I give you some advice? I know I have no right to do so.
Of course.
Your father may have had a secret that he took with him to the other side, and that seems to be causing you confusion. I think I can understand how you feel, but you shouldn't peep any more into that dark entrance. Leave that up to cats. If you keep doing so, you will never go anywhere. Better to think about the future.
The hole has to be closed up, Tengo said.
Exactly, Kumi said. The owl says the same thing. Do you remember the owl?
Of course. The owl is the guardian deity of the woods, knows all, and gives us the wisdom of the night. Is that owl still hooting in the woods?
The owl's not going anywhere, Kumi replied. He'll be there for a long time.
Kumi saw him off on the train to Tateyama, as though she needed to make sure with her own eyes that he had boarded the train and left town. She stood on the platform and kept waving to him until he couldn't see her anymore. It was 7 p.m. on Tuesday when he got back to his apartment in Koenji. Tengo turned on the lights, sat down at his dining table, and looked around the room. The place looked the same as when he had left early the previous morning. The curtains were closed tight, and there was a printout of the story he was writing on top of his desk. 6 neatly sharpened pencils in a pencil holder. Clean dishes still in the rack in the sink. Time was silently ticking by. The calendar on the wall indicating that this was the final month of the year. The room seemed even more silent than ever. A little too silent. Something excessive seemed included in that silence, though maybe he was imagining it. Maybe it was because he had just witnessed a person vanishing right before his eyes. The hole in the world might not yet be fully closed up. He drank a glass of water and took a hot shower. He shampooed his hair thoroughly, cleaned his ears, clipped his nails. He took a new pair of underwear and a shirt from his drawer and put them on. He had to get rid of all the smells that clung to him, the smells of the cat town. "We all like you a lot here, but this isn't a place you should stay for long," Kumi Adachi had told him. He had no appetite. He didn't feel like working or opening a book. Listening to music held no appeal. His body was exhausted, but his nerves were on edge, so he knew that even if he lay down, he wouldn't get any sleep. Something about the silence seemed contrived. "It would be nice if Fuka Eri were here," Tengo thought. "I don't care what silly, meaningless things she might talk about. Her fateful lack of intonation, the way her voice rose at the end of questions. It's all fine by me. I haven't heard her voice in a while, and I miss it." But Tengo knew that she wouldn't be coming back to his apartment again. Why he knew this, he couldn't say exactly. But he knew that she would never be there again. Probably. He wanted to talk with someone. Anyone. His older girlfriend would be nice, but he couldn't reach her. She was irretrievably lost. He dialed Komatsu's office number, his direct extension, but nobody answered. After 15 rings, he gave up. He tried to think of the other people he could call, but there wasn't anyone. He thought of calling Kumi, but realized he didn't have her number. His mind turned to a dark hole somewhere in the world, not yet filled in. Not such a big hole, but very deep. If I look in that hole and speak loudly enough, would I be able to talk with my father? Will the dead tell me what the truth is? "If you do that, you'll never go anywhere," Kumi Adachi had told him. "Better to think about the future." "I don't agree. That's not all there is to it. Knowing the secret may not take me anywhere, but still, I have to know the reason why it won't. If I truly understand the reason, maybe I will be able to go somewhere." "Whether you are my real father or not doesn't matter anymore," Tengo said to the dark hole. "Either one is fine with me. Either way, you took a part of me with you to the grave, and I remain here with a part of you. That fact won't change, whether we are related by blood or not. Enough time has passed for that to be the case, and the world has moved on." He thought he heard an owl hooting outside, but it was only his ears playing tricks on him.
Chapter 25. Ushikawa. Cold or not, God is present. "You won't die that easily," the man's voice said from behind him, like he had been reading Ushikawa's mind. "You just lost consciousness for a moment, though you were right on the edge of it." It was a voice he had never heard before, neutral, utterly devoid of expression, not too high or low, neither too hard nor too soft. The kind of voice that announces airplane departures or stock market reports. "What day of the week is it?" Ushikawa thought randomly. "Must be Monday night. No, technically, it might already be Tuesday." "Ushikawa," the man said. "You don't mind if I call you Ushikawa, do you?" Ushikawa didn't reply. There was silence for a good 20 seconds. Then, without warning, the man gave him a short, clipped punch to his left kidney. Silent, but a punch with force behind it. Excruciating pain shot through his whole body. All his internal organs clenched, and until the pain had subsided a little, he couldn't breathe. Finally, he was able to get out a dry wheeze. "I asked you politely, and I expect a reply. If you still can't talk, then just nod or shake your head. That's enough. That's what it means to be polite," the man said. "It's okay to call you Ushikawa?" Ushikawa nodded several times. "Ushikawa. An easy name to remember. I went through the wallet in your trousers. Your driver's license and business cards were in there. Full-time director, New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship and the Arts. A pretty fancy title, wouldn't you say? What would a full-time director of the New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship and the Arts be doing shooting photos with a hidden camera in a place like this?" Ushikawa was silent. He still couldn't get the words out easily. "You had best reply," the man said. "Consider this a warning. If your kidney bursts, it'll hurt like hell the rest of your life."
"I'm doing surveillance on the residents,"
Ushikawa finally managed to say. His voice was unsteady, cracking in spots. To him, blindfolded, it didn't sound like his own. "You mean Tango Kawana?" Ushikawa nodded. "The Tango Kawana who ghost wrote Air Chrysalis." Ushikawa nodded again, and then had a fit of coughing. The man knew all this already. "Who hired you to do this?" the man asked.
"Sakagake."
"That much I could figure out, Ushikawa," the man said. "The question is why, at this late date, Sakigake would want to keep watch over Tengo Kawana's movements. Tengo Kawana can't be that important to them." Ushikawa's mind raced, trying to figure out who this man was and how much he knew. He didn't know who the man was, but it was clear Sakigake hadn't sent him. Whether that was good news or bad, Ushikawa didn't know. "There is a question pending," the man said. He pressed a finger against Uchikawa's left kidney, very hard.
"There's a woman he's connected with,"
Ushikawa groaned. "Does this woman have a name?"
"Aomame."
"Why are they pursuing Aomame?" the man asked.
"She brought harm to leader, the head of Sakigake."
"Brought harm," the man said, as if verifying the phrase. "You mean she killed him, right? To put it more simply."
"That's right,"
Ushikawa said. He knew he couldn't hide anything from this man. Sooner or later, he would have to talk.
"It's a secret within the religion."
"How many people in Sakigake know this secret?"
"A handful."
"Including you?" Ushikawa nodded. "So you must occupy a very high position."
"No,"
Ushikawa said, and shook his head, his bruised kidney aching.
"I'm simply a messenger. I just happened to find out about it."
"In the wrong place at the wrong time, is that what you're saying?"
"I think so."
"By the way, Ushikawa, are you working alone?" Ushikawa nodded. "I find that strange. Normally a team would conduct surveillance. To do a decent job of it, you would also need someone to run supplies, so three people at the minimum. And you're already deeply connected with an organization. Doing it all alone strikes me as unnatural. In other words, I'm not exactly pleased with your reply."
"I am not a follower of the religion,"
Ushikawa said. His breathing had calmed down, and he was finally able to speak close to normally. I was hired by them. They call on me when they think it's more convenient to hire an outsider. As a full-time director of the New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship and the Arts? That's just a front. There's no such organization. It was mainly set up by Sakigake for tax purposes. I'm an individual contractor with no ties to the religion. I just work for them. A mercenary of sorts. No, not a mercenary. I'm collecting information at their request. If anything rough needs to get done, it's handled by other people. So, Ushikawa, you were instructed by Sakigake to do surveillance here on Tengo and probe into his connection with Aomame. Correct. No, the man said. That's the wrong answer. If Sakigake knew for a fact that there's a connection between Aomame and Tengo Kuwana, they wouldn't have sent you by yourself on the stakeout. They would have put together a team of their own people. That would reduce the chance for mistakes, and they could resort to force if need be. I'm telling you the truth. I'm just doing what the people above me told me to do. Why they're having me do it alone, I have no idea. The pitch of Ushikawa's voice was still unsteady, and it cracked in places. If he finds out that Sakigake doesn't yet know the connection between Aomame and Tengo, Ushikawa thought, I might be whacked right here and now. If I'm no longer in the picture, then nobody will be any the wiser about their connection. I'm not very fond of incorrect answers, the man said in a chilly tone. I think you, of all people, are well aware of that. I wouldn't mind giving your kidney another punch, but if I hit you hard, my hand will hurt, and permanently damaging your kidney isn't what I came here to do. I have no personal animosity toward you. I have just one goal, to get the right answer. So I'm going to try a different approach. I'm sending you to the bottom of the sea. The bottom of the sea? Ushikawa thought. What is this guy talking about? The man pulled something out of his pocket. There was a rustling sound like plastic rubbing together, and then something covered Ushikawa's head. A plastic bag, the thick freezer bag kind. Then a thick, large rubber band was wrapped around his neck. This guy is trying to suffocate me, Ushikawa realized. He tried breathing in but got a mouthful of plastic instead. His nostrils were blocked as well. His lungs were screaming for air, but there wasn't any. The plastic molded tight to his whole face like a death mask. Soon, all his muscles started to convulse violently. He tried to reach out to rip away the bag, but his hands wouldn't move. They were tied tight behind his back. His brain blew up like a balloon and felt ready to explode. He tried to scream. He had to get air. But no sound came out. His tongue filled his mouth as his consciousness drained away. Finally, the rubber band was taken from his neck, the plastic bag peeled away from his head. Ushikawa desperately gulped down the air in front of him. For a few minutes, he bent forward, breathing mightily like an animal lunging at something just out of reach. How was the bottom of the sea? The man asked after Ushikawa's breathing had settled down. His voice was, as before, expressionless. You went quite deep down. I imagine you saw all sorts of things you've never seen before. A valuable experience. Ushikawa couldn't respond. His voice wouldn't come. Ushikawa, as I have said a number of times, I am looking for the correct answer. So I'll ask you once again. Were you instructed by Sakigake to track down Tengo Kuwana's movements and search for his connection with Aomame? This is a critical point. A person's life is on the line. Think carefully before you answer. I'll know if you're lying. Sakigake doesn't know about
this,
Uchikawa managed to stammer. Good. That's the correct answer. Sakegake doesn't know yet about the connection between Aomame and Tango Kawana. You haven't told them yet. Is that correct? Uchikawa nodded. If you had answered correctly from the start, you wouldn't have had to visit the bottom of the sea. Pretty awful, wasn't it? Uchikawa nodded. I know. I went through the same thing once, the man said, as easily as if he were chatting about some trivial gossip. Only people who have experienced it know how horrible it really is. You can't easily generalize about pain. Each kind of pain has its own characteristics. To rephrase Tolstoy's famous line, all happiness is alike, but each pain is painful in its own way. I wouldn't go so far, though, as to say you savor it. Don't you agree? Uchikawa nodded. He was still panting a little. The man went on. So let's be frank with each other, and totally honest. Does that sound like a good idea, Uchikawa? Uchikawa nodded. Any more incorrect answers, and I'll have you take another walk on the bottom of the sea. A longer, more leisurely stroll this time. We'll push the envelope a bit more. If we botch it, you might not come back. I don't think you want to go there. What do you say, Uchikawa? Uchikawa shook his head. It seems like we have one thing in common, the man said. We're both lone wolves, or maybe dogs who got separated from the pack. Rogue operators who don't fit in with society. People who have an instinctive dislike of organizations or aren't accepted by any organization. We take care of business alone, decide things on our own, take action on our own, take responsibility on our own. We take orders from above, but have no colleagues or subordinates. All we depend on is our brain and our abilities. Do I have it right? Uchikawa nodded. The man continued. That's our strength, but also, at times, our weak point. For example, in this case, I think you were a little too eager to be successful. You wanted to sort it out by yourself without informing Sakegake. You wanted to wrap things up neatly and take all the credit. That's why you let your guard down. Isn't it? Uchikawa nodded once more. Why did you have to take things that far?
Because it was my fault. Leader died.
How so?
I'm the one who ran the background check on Aomame. I did a thorough check on her before letting her see Leader, and I couldn't find anything suspicious at all.
But she got close to Leader, hoping to kill him, and actually did deliver a fatal blow. You messed up your assignment, and you knew that someday you would have to answer for it. You're just a disposable outsider, after all. And you know too much for your own good. To survive this, you knew you had to deliver Aomame's head to them, am I correct? Uchikawa nodded. Sorry about that, the man said.
Sorry about that.
Ushikawa's misshapen head pondered this. Then it came to him.
Are you the one who planned Leader's murder? He asked.
The man didn't respond, but Uchikawa took his silence as not necessarily a denial.
What are you going to do with me?
Uchikawa asked. What indeed? Truth be told, I haven't decided yet. I'm going to take my time and think about it. It all depends on how you play this, Tamaru said. I still have a few questions I want to ask you. Uchikawa nodded. I would like you to tell me the phone number of your contact at Sakegake. You must report to someone there. Uchikawa hesitated a moment, but then told him the number. With his life hanging in the balance, he wasn't about to hide it. Tamaru wrote it down. His name?
I don't know his name,
Uchikawa lied. Tamaru didn't seem to mind.
Pretty tough characters?
I'd say so.
But not real pros.
They're skilled, and they follow orders from the top, no questions asked, but they're not pros.
How much do they know about Aomame?
Tamaru asked.
Do they know where she's hiding?
Uchikawa shook his head.
They don't know yet, which is why I stayed here doing surveillance on Dango Kiwana. If I knew where Aomame is, I would have moved operations over there a long time ago.
Makes sense, Tamaru said. Speaking of which, how did you figure out the connection between Aomame and Dango Kiwana?
Legwork.
How so?
I reviewed her background from A to Z. I went back to her childhood when she was attending the public elementary school in Ichikawa. Dango Kiwana is also from Ichikawa, so I wondered if there could have been a connection. I went to the elementary school to look into it, and sure enough, they were in the same class for 2 years.
Tamaru made a low, cat-like growl deep in his throat.
I see. A very tenacious investigation, Uchikawa, I must say. It must have taken a long time and energy. Impressive.
Uchikawa said nothing. There wasn't a question pending.
To repeat my question, Tamaru said, at the present time, you are the only one who knows about the connection between Aomame and Dango Kiwana.
You know about it?
Not counting me. Those you associate with.
Uchikawa nodded.
I am the only one involved who knows. Yes.
You're telling the truth?
I am.
By the way, did you know that Aomame is pregnant?
Pregnant?
Uchikawa said. His voice revealed his surprise.
Whose child is it?
Tamaru didn't answer his question.
You really didn't know?
No, I didn't. Believe me.
Tamaru silently considered his response for a moment, and then spoke.
All right. It does appear that you didn't know this. I believe you. On another topic, you were sniffing around the Willow House in Azabu for a while, correct?
Uchikawa nodded.
Why? The lady who owns it went to a local sports club and Aomame was her personal trainer. It seems they had a close personal relationship. That lady also set up a safe house for battered women on the grounds of her estate. The security there was extremely tight. In my opinion, a little too tight, so I assumed Aomame might be hiding in that safe house.
And then what happened?
I decided that wasn't the case. The lady has plenty of money and power. If she wanted to hide Aomame, she wouldn't do it so close at hand. She would put her somewhere far away. So I gave up checking out the Azabu mansion and turned my attention to Dango Kiwana.
Tamaru gave a low growl again.
You have excellent intuition. You're very logical, not to mention patient. Kind of a waste to have you be an errand boy. Have you always been in this line of work?
I used to be a lawyer,
Uchikawa said.
I see. You must have been very good. But I imagine you got carried away, botched up things, and took a fall. These are hard times now, and you're working for next to nothing as an errand boy for this new religious group. Do I have this right?
Uchikawa nodded.
Yes. That about sums it up.
Nothing you can do about it, Tamaru said. For mavericks like us, it's not easy to live a normal, everyday life.
It might look like we're doing okay for a while, but then we definitely trip up.
That's the way the world operates.
Tomaru cracked his knuckles, a sharp, ominous sound. So does Sakigake know about the Willow House?
I haven't told anyone,
Ushikawa replied truthfully.
When I said that something about the mansion smells fishy, that was my own conjecture, nothing more. The security was too tight for me to confirm anything.
Good, Tomaru said.
You were the one who made sure of that, weren't you?
Tomaru didn't answer. Up till now, you've answered truthfully, Tomaru said. In general, at least. Once you sink to the bottom of the sea, you lose the power to lie. If you tried to lie now, it would show in your voice. That's what fear will do to you.
I'm not lying, Ushikawa said.
Glad to hear it, Tomaru said. No one wants to feel any more pain than they have to. By the way, have you heard of Carl Jung? Under the blindfold, Ushikawa instinctively frowned.
Carl Jung? What was this guy getting at? Carl Jung, the psychologist?
Exactly.
I know a little about him,
Ushikawa said carefully.
He was born at the end of the 19th century in Switzerland. He was a disciple of Freud's, but broke with him. He coined the term collective unconsciousness. That's about all I know.
That's plenty, Tomaru said. Ushikawa waited for him to continue. Carl Jung, Tomaru said, had an elegant house in a quiet lakeside residential area of Zurich, and lived an affluent life with his family. But he needed a place where he could be alone in order to meditate on weighty issues. He found a small parcel of land on one corner of the lake in an area called Bollingen, and built a small house there. Not exactly a villa or anything that grand. He piled the stones one by one himself and constructed a round house with high ceilings. The stones had been taken from a nearby quarry. In those days in Switzerland, you had to have a stonemason's license in order to build anything out of stone, so Jung went to the trouble of obtaining a license. He even joined the Stonemasons Guild. Building this house and doing it with his own hands was very important to him. His mother's death also seemed to be one of the major factors that led to him constructing this home. Tomaru paused for a moment. This house was dubbed the Tower. He designed it so it resembled the village huts he had seen on a trip to Africa. The inside was one big open space where everything went on, a very simple residence. He felt this was all one needed to live. The house had no electricity, gas, or running water. He got water from the nearby mountains. What he found out later, though, was that this was just an archetype and nothing else. As time went on, he found it necessary to build partitions and divisions in the house, a second floor, and later he added on several wings. He created paintings himself on the wall. These were suggestive of the development and split in the individual consciousness. The whole house functioned as a sort of three-dimensional mandala. It took him 12 years to complete the entire house. For Jungian researchers, it's an extremely intriguing building. Have you heard of this before? Ushikawa shook his head. The house is still standing on the banks of the lake in Zurich. Jung's descendants manage it, but unfortunately it's not open to the public, so people can't view the interior. Rumor has it, though, that at the entrance to the original tower, there is a stone into which Jung carved some words with his own hand. Cold or not, God is present. That's what he carved into the stone himself. Tomaru paused again. Cold or not, God is present. he intoned quietly once more. Do you know what this means? Ushikawa shook his head.
No, I don't.
I can imagine. I'm not sure myself what it means. There's some kind of deep illusion there, something difficult to interpret. But consider this. In this house that Carl Jung built, piling up the stones with his own hands, at the very entrance, he found the need to chisel out, again with his own hands, these words. I don't know why, but I've been drawn to these words for a long time. I find them hard to understand, but the difficulty in understanding makes it all the more profound. I don't know much about God. I was raised in a Catholic orphanage and had some awful experiences there, so I don't have a good impression of God. And it was always cold there, even in the summer. It was either really cold or outrageously cold, one or the other. If there is a God, I can't say he treated me very well. Despite all this, those words of Jung's quietly sank deep into the folds of my soul. Sometimes I close my eyes and repeat them over and over, and they make me strangely calm. Cold or not, God is present. Sorry, but could you say that out loud?
Cold or not, God is present.
Ushikawa repeated in a weak voice, not really sure what he was saying. I can't hear you very well.
Cold or not, God is present.
This time Ushikawa said it as distinctly as he could. Tomaru shut his eyes, enjoying the overtones of the words. Eventually, as if he had made up his mind about something, he took a deep breath and let it out. He opened his eyes and looked at his hands. He had on disposable latex gloves so he wouldn't leave behind any fingerprints.
I'm sorry about this,
Tomaru said in a low voice. His tone was solemn. He took out the plastic bag again, put it over Ushikawa's head, and wrapped the thick rubber band around his neck. His movements were swift and decisive. Ushikawa was about to protest, but the words didn't form, and they never reached anyone's ears.
Why is he doing this?
Ushikawa thought from inside the plastic bag.
I told him everything I know, so why does he have to kill me?
In his head about to burst, he thought of his little house in Choringkan, and about his two young daughters, and the dog they owned. The dog was small and low to the ground, and Ushikawa never could bring himself to like it. The dog never liked him either. The dog wasn't very bright and barked incessantly. It chewed the rugs and peed on the new flooring in the hallway. It was a totally different creature from the clever mutt he had had as a child. Still, Ushikawa's final conscious thoughts in this life were of that silly little dog scampering around the lawn in their backyard. Tomaru watched as Ushikawa, his body tightly bound into a ball, writhed on the tatami like some huge fish out of water. Ushikawa's arms and legs were tied behind him, so no matter how much he struggled, the neighbors next door wouldn't hear a thing. Tomaru knew very well what a hideous way to die this was. But it was the most efficient, cleanest way to kill someone. No screams, no blood. Tomaru followed the second hand on his Tag Heuer diver's watch. After 3 minutes, Ushikawa stopped thrashing around. His body trembled slightly as if resonating to something, and then the trembling stopped. Tomaru looked at his wristwatch for another 3 minutes. He felt Ushikawa's wrist for a pulse and confirmed that all signs of life had vanished. There was a faint whiff of urine. Ushikawa had lost control of his bladder again, this time emptying it completely. understandable considering how much he had suffered. Tomorrow removed the rubber band and peeled away the plastic bag. The bag had been partly sucked into his mouth. Uchikawa's eyes were wide, his mouth open and twisted to one side in death. His dirty, irregular teeth were bared, his tongue with its greenish moss visible. It was the kind of expression Munch might have painted. Uchikawa's normally misshapen head looked even more lopsided. He must have suffered terribly. "I'm sorry about this," Tomaru said. "I didn't do it because I wanted to." Tomaru used his fingers to relax the muscles of Uchikawa's face, straighten out the jaw, and make his face more presentable. He used a kitchen towel to wipe away the drool from Ushikawa's mouth. It took a while, but his face began to look a bit better. At least a person looking at it wouldn't avert their eyes. But no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't get Ushikawa's eyes to shut. "Shakespeare said it best," Tomaru said quietly as he gazed at that lumpish, misshapen head. "Something along these lines. If we die today, we do not have to die tomorrow, so let us look to the best in each other." Was this from Henry IV or maybe Richard III? Tomaru couldn't recall. To him, though, that wasn't important, and he doubted Uchikawa wanted to know the precise reference. Tomaru untied his arms and legs. He had used a soft, towel-like rope, and he had a special way of tying it so as not to leave marks. He took the rope, the plastic bag, and the heavy-duty rubber band and stowed them in a plastic bag he had brought with him for that purpose. He rummaged through Ushikawa's belongings and collected every photo he had taken. He put the camera and the tripod in the bag as well. It would only lead to trouble if it got out that Uchikawa had been conducting surveillance. People would ask who he was watching, and the chances were pretty good that Tango Kawana's name would surface. He took Ushikawa's notebook, too, crammed full of detailed notes. He made sure to collect anything of importance. All that was left behind were the sleeping bag, eating utensils, extra clothes, and Ushikawa's pitiful corpse. Finally, Tomaru took out one of Ushikawa's business cards, the ones that said he was full-time director, New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship in the Arts, and pocketed it. "I'm really sorry," Tomaru said again as he was leaving. Tomaru went into a phone booth near the station, inserted a telephone card into the slot, and dialed the number Uchikawa had given him. It was a local Tokyo number, Shibuya Ward, by the look of it. The phone rang 6 times before someone answered. Tomaru skipped the preliminaries and told him the address and room number of the apartment in Koenji. "Did you write it down? Could you repeat it?" Tomaru did so. The man wrote it down and read it back. "Uchikawa is there," Tomaru said. "You are familiar with Uchikawa?" "Uchikawa?" Tomaru ignored what he said and continued. "Uchikawa is there, and unfortunately he isn't breathing anymore. It doesn't look like a natural death. There are several business cards with full-time director, New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship in the Arts on them in his business card holder. If the police find these, eventually they will figure out the connection with you. That wouldn't be to your advantage, I imagine. Best to dispose of everything as soon as you can. That's what you're good at." "Who are you?" the man asked. "Let's just say I'm a kind informant," Tomaru said. "I'm not so fond of the police myself, same as you." "Not a natural death?" "Well, he didn't die of old age, or very peacefully." The man was quiet for a moment. "What was this Uchikawa doing there?" "I don't know," You would have to ask him the details, and as I explained, he's not in a position to respond. The man on the other end of the line paused. You must be connected with the young woman who came to the Hotel Okura. That's not the sort of question to which you can expect an answer. I'm one of the people who met her. Tell her that, and she'll understand. I have a message for her. I'm listening. We're not planning to harm her, the man said. My understanding is that you are trying your best to track her down. That's right. We've been trying to locate her for some time. Yet you're telling me you don't plan to harm her, Tamaru said. Why is that? There was a short silence before the response came. At a certain point, the situation changed. Leader's death was deeply mourned by everyone, but that's over. Finished. Leader was ill, and in a sense, he was hoping to put an end to his suffering. So we don't plan to pursue Aomame any further regarding this matter. Instead, we would simply like to talk with her. About what? Areas of common interest. That's just what your people want. You may feel the need to speak with her, but maybe that isn't what she wants. There should be room for discussion. There are things that we can provide you. Freedom, for instance, and safety. Knowledge and information. Can't we find a neutral place to discuss this? Name the location. We will go wherever you say. I guarantee her safety 100%, and not just hers, but the safety of everyone involved. There's no need to run away anymore. I think this is a reasonable request for both sides. That's what you say, Tamaru said. But there is no reason I should trust you. At any rate, I would appreciate it if you would let Aomame know, the man said patiently. Time is of the essence, and we're still willing to meet you halfway. If you need more proof of our reliability, we'll provide it. You can call here any time and get in touch with us. I wonder if you could give me a few more details. Why is she so important to you? What happened to bring about this transformation? The man took a short breath before he replied. We have to keep hearing the voice. For us, it's like a never-ending well, and we can't ever lose it. That's all I can tell you at this time. And you need Aomame in order to keep that well? It's hard to explain. It's connected, but that's all I can say. What about Eriko Fukada? You don't need her anymore? No, not anymore. We don't care where she is or what she's doing. Her mission is finished. What mission? That's sensitive information, the man said after a pause. I'm sorry, but I can't reveal anything more at this time. I suggest you consider your position very carefully, Tamaru said. In this game we're playing, it's my serve. We can get in touch with you any time we want, but you can't get in touch with us. You don't even know who we are, correct? You're right. You do have the advantage. We don't know who you are. But this isn't something we should speak about on the phone. I've already said too much, more than I'm authorized to. Tamaru was silent for some time. All right. We'll consider your proposal. We need to talk it over on our end. I will probably be getting in touch with you later. I will be waiting to hear from you, the man said. As I said before, this could be to the advantage of both sides. What if we ignore your proposal or reject it? Then we would have to do things our way. We have a certain amount of power, and unfortunately, things might get a little rough. This could cause problems for everyone involved. No matter who you are, you won't come through this unscathed. I don't see how that could be the ideal outcome for either of us.
You may be right, but it will take a while before we get to that point. And as you said, time is of the essence.
The man gave a small cough.
It might take time, or maybe not so much. You won't know unless you try.
Exactly, the man said. There's one more important thing I need to point out. To borrow your metaphor, in this game, it's your serve. But it doesn't seem to me like you're familiar with the basic rules of the game. That's another thing you can't know unless you actually try it. If you do try it and it doesn't work, that would be a shame.
For both of us,
Tamaru said. A short, suggestive silence followed.
What do you plan to do about Ushikawa?
Tamaru asked. We'll take charge of him at the earliest opportunity, as early as tonight.
The apartment is unlocked.
Much appreciated, the man said.
By the way, will you all deeply mourn Ushikawa's death?
We deeply mourn any person's death.
You should mourn over him. He was, in his own way, a capable man.
But not capable enough. Is that what you're saying?
No man is capable enough to live forever.
So you say, the man said.
Yes, I do think that, don't you?
I'll wait for your call, the man said without answering, his voice cold. Tamaru silently hung up the phone. There was no need for any more talk. If he wanted to talk further, he would call them. He left the phone booth and walked to where he had parked his car, an old, drab, dark blue Toyota Corolla van, totally inconspicuous. He drove for 15 minutes, pulled up next to an empty park, checked that there was no one watching, and tossed the plastic bag with the rope and the rubber band into a trash can, plus the surgical gloves.
They deeply mourn any person's death,
Tamaru said in a low voice as he started the engine and snapped on his seatbelt.
Good. That's what's most important, he thought. Everyone's death should be mourned, even if just for a short time.
Chapter 26. Aomame. Very romantic. The phone rang at just past noon on Tuesday. Aomame was seated on her yoga mat, legs wide apart, stretching her iliopsoas muscles. It was a much more strenuous exercise than it looked. A light sheen of perspiration was starting to seep through her shirt. She stopped, wiped her face with a towel, and answered the phone.
Bobblehead is no longer in that apartment,
Tamaru said, as always omitting any sort of greeting. No hellos for him. He's not there anymore?
No, he's not. He was persuaded.
Persuaded, Aomame repeated. She imagined this meant that Tamaru had, through some means, forcibly removed Bobblehead.
Also, the person named Kawana who lives in that building is the Tengo Kawana you have been looking for.
The world around Aomame expanded, then contracted as if it were her own heart.
Are you listening?
Tamaru asked.
I am. But Tengo Kawana isn't in his apartment right now. He has been gone for a couple of days.
Is he all right?
He's not in Tokyo now, but he's definitely all right. Bobblehead rented an apartment in Tengo's building and was waiting there for you to come see Tengo. He had set up a hidden camera and was keeping watch over the entrance.
Did he take my picture?
He took 3 photos of you. It was nighttime, and you had on a hat, glasses, and a muffler, so you can't see any facial details in the photos. But it's you. If you had gone there 1 more time, things could have gotten sticky. so I made the right choice leaving things up to you. If there is such a thing as a right choice here. Anyway, Almama said, I don't have to worry about him. That man won't be trying to do you any harm anymore. Because you persuaded him. I had to adjust some things as we went, but in the end, yes, Tamaru said. I got all the photos. Bobblehead's aim was to wait until you showed up, and Tengo Kawana was merely the bait he was using to reel you in. So I can't see that they would have any reason now to harm Tengo. He should be fine. That's a relief, Almama said. Tengo teaches math at a cram school in Yoyogi. He is apparently an excellent teacher, but he only works a few days a week, so he doesn't make much money. He's still single, and he lives modestly in that simple apartment. When Almama closed her eyes, she could hear her heartbeat inside her ears. The boundary between herself and the world seemed blurred. Besides teaching math at the cram school, he is writing a novel. A long one. Ghostwriting Air Chrysalis was just a side job. He has his own literary ambitions, which is a good thing. A certain amount of ambition helps a person grow. How did you find all this out? He's gone now, so I let myself into his apartment. It was locked. Not that I would count that as a lock. I feel bad about invading his privacy, but I needed to do a basic check. For a man living alone, he keeps his place clean. He had even scrubbed the gas stove. The inside of his fridge was very neat, no rotten cabbage or anything tucked away in the back. I could see he had done some ironing as well. Not a bad partner for you to have. As long as he isn't gay, I mean. What else did you find out? I called the cram school and asked about his teaching schedule. The girl who answered the phone said that Tengo's father passed away late Sunday night in a hospital somewhere in Chiba Prefecture. He had to leave Tokyo for the funeral, and his Monday classes were canceled. She didn't know when or where the funeral would take place. His next class is on Thursday, so it seems he will be back by then. Almame remembered that Tengo's father was an NHK fee collector. On Sundays, Tengo had made the rounds of his father's collection route with him. She and Tengo had run across each other a number of times on the streets of Ichikawa. She couldn't remember his father's face very well. He was a small, thin man who wore a fee collector's uniform. He didn't look at all like Tengo. Since there's no more bobblehead, is it all right if I go see Tengo? That's not a good idea, Tamaru shot back. Bobblehead was persuaded, but I had to get in touch with Sakegake to get them to take care of one last piece of business. There was one particular article I didn't want to fall into the hands of the authorities. If that had been discovered, the residents of the apartment would have been gone over with a fine-tooth comb, and your friend might have gotten mixed up in it, too. It would have been difficult for me to wrap up everything by myself. If the authorities spotted me lugging that article out in the middle of the night and questioned me, I don't know how I would talk my way out of it. Sakigake has the manpower and the resources, and that's the sort of thing they're used to. Like the time they transported another article out of the Hotel Okura. Do you follow what I'm saying? In her mind, Almama translated Tamaru's terminology into more straightforward vocabulary. So this persuasion got rather rough, I take it. Tamaru gave a low groan. I feel bad about it. But that man knew too much. Was Sakegake aware of what Bobblehead was doing in that apartment? He was working for them, but on that front, he was acting on his own. He hadn't yet reported to his superiors on what he was doing. Fortunately for us. But by now they must know that he was up to something. Correct. So you had best not go near there for a while.